The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 24th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Black Friday, but we bring you Autumn of the Black Snake, the creation of the U.S. Army and the invasion that opened the West, by William Hoglund. It is a fascinating story of not only the creation of a standing army in this country, but the forces behind that and the birth, maybe in some ways these 3 or 4 years that this book focuses on, insert the DNA of imperialism into the American body politic. I think that actually came out well. Not to pat myself on the back, but why not? Recovering from Thanksgiving? I don't know why I say recovering. Well, I know why I say recovering, because my whole family will be there. So I'm recovering. I'm in recovery. Also, we're going to have, for members, we're going to have all sorts of... We might. I don't know if it's going to be a Matt pick. But we may have... I know that, like, the no shopping chorus, I can't remember. Reverend Billy came into the studio once back in the deep archive days of the Majority Report, and they sang. It was honestly one of the strangest things in the world, because we had, I think there was like 12 people in the chorus came in to the studio, and they sang like a chorus. It was pretty crazy. And then maybe Mal throw something else in there, like a Waterman call.
Well, you'll get Michael Brooks' show content. It's going to be one of the things that only the members get on Sundays. Michael is doing the history of Michael Manley's socialism in Jamaica and it getting crushed.
All right, we're going to give that for free, though. That's going to be for the member, for the non-member. Just everybody's going to get that.
I guess that'll be everyone. Okay,
Give it to everybody. Come on, it's Black Friday. You can either go spend some money on something or you can do this.
Have a free show.
With that said, though, justcoffee.coop, use the coupon code MRHOLIDAY, and you will get free shipping and 30% off your coffee. What? No, Sam, I'm sorry. Let me hit rewind. I got to hit that rewind 15-second button. Did you just say MRHOLIDAY gets you 30% off gourmet fair trade coffee? What? At justcoffee.coop, and you can get the MR Majority Report blend. I'm living in some type of like crazy. I'm still drunk from yesterday. That's what's going on. The turkey, all that tryptophan, is that what it is? Isn't that like a myth that
that's what
fall
they say,
asleep?
Yeah.
I don't buy that stuff for a moment.
I think it's people pretending to sleep to have a respite from their relatives.
You're really going to love this interview. I really enjoyed doing it, and it's fascinating. And then you're going to go out and you're going to buy the book. And if you do so, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. And then, you know, use that link in the future for different reasons. All right, folks. Don't forget, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And we will be back live on Monday. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, or a happy Thanksgiving, as they say. Remember, this is the season where we begin the war on Christmas. We'll be starting that sometime next week. And we will see you then. In the meantime, enjoy your weekend. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome William Hoglund. He is the author of The Whiskey Rebellion, Founding Finance, The Declaration, and his latest is The Autumn of the Black Snake, the origin story of the American military. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So, okay, you're working with a relatively small amount of time, or I guess it is the essence of your book, that is basically the first half of the 1790s. And it is, as you set out, a massive turning point. Of course, is a fairly nascent United States, but a massive turning point in the trajectory of the United States. What, I mean, before we get into the details and some of the characters that we're talking about, why is that?
Well, I think generally the 1790s is probably seen as a big, you know, it's the launch moment, right, of the nation. But what I'm talking about is surprisingly little known in that context, which is that one of the great achievements of the Washington administration, and one of the most, I think, world-changing achievements, was the establishment of a United States Army. Although when I say that, I think it's kind of tricky because people sort of assume there must have always been an army since there was a nation formed, but there wasn't one. And the formation of that army, I think, is a huge benchmark, a huge turning of a wheel in global history, not just U.S. history. And at the same time, it's the beginning of the conquest of the rest of the continent, what became the conquest of the rest of the continent, in that the first war the United States ever fought occurred in the first half of the 1790s. And that's the reason they formed the army. And that was the war to conquer what is now the upper Midwest, basically Ohio and et cetera, which begins an entire change in the relations of indigenous people and the United States of America, and so forth. So all of that seems, you know, crucially important to me, and that's why I kind of got into reading about it and writing the book.
I'm going to resist the temptation to jump immediately into which came first, right? The imperialist, the imperialist agenda or the war? I mean, the standing army. But before we get there, let's dig into sort of the story, because it starts essentially, or maybe this is a little bit too late in it, but it is the St. Clair's defeat, which is the ostensible impetus. But tell us about who had who was the argument between prior to this about whether or not the United States should have a standing army, and give us a basic outlines of those arguments.
There was a strong feeling among many Americans, elite and ordinary Americans alike, that in a kind of government that had just, you know, been established, the kind of government that actually the revolution had been fought possibly to create, a Republican government, a representative government, that a full-time professional, nationally run sort of top-down army was just anathema to all of those basic Republican values. I mean, the standing army is a term that was used. It was a term of abhorrence, basically, among many of the Whig thinkers who had created the ideology around American independence. It was the kind of thing where it's the kind of army that the King of England had, or the King of France had, a professional sort of army used, you know, hirelings of the king, just could be turned against the citizenry at any time, you know, a sign of tyranny, really. That was a pretty widespread opinion. And the idea was then a free people would never have a standing army. A free people would rely on the, you know, volunteer obligated citizen soldier, the militia. That's a pretty common theme that still continues in American debates about military, actually. I mean, we still romanticize militia. A lot of people in this country do. But there was another point of view, and it was held by some pretty famous people like George Washington and Henry Knox, who became Secretary of War and had been Washington's artillery commander during the Revolution, and, of course, Alexander Hamilton, and others who had long believed, I mean, even during the Revolution, had just been sort of horrified by what they considered the poor performance of the non-professional forces, and really were pushing for more professionalism even during the revolution. They felt that the only way to really have an effective nationhood would be also to have an effective army, and that army would have to be run once you have a nation, it would have to be a nationally, uniformly run, uniformly, you know, uniformly clothed, like uniformed, and uniformly trained and so forth, army that would be ready to react to situations, not have to be raised from the public kind of at the last minute and so forth. So that was a big debate, and it was absolutely not fait accompli, politically speaking, that there would ever be a United States Army. So to achieve one, and that's part of what my book's about, the Washington administration had to make some very big moves on the one hand, and sort of backroom moves on the other hand, to get that done politically.
Well, and unstated in those two sides of the argument is sort of, it seems to me, like a third option, right? Where it's not just that we need a standing army in the event that we have a sudden need for it. It also, and it's not that we want a standing army to be tyrannical to our own population. There's a certain amount of unspoken, I mean, I guess the siren call is just taking me. Was there a hidden agenda, an expressed agenda of, or was it even at that time even considered an agenda of imperialism, if we're talking about Native Americans who were, you know, any more than, you know, homesteading or clearing this field of trees is imperialism or thought of as imperialism? I mean,
go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, I think you know where I'm going with this. I mean, was this a hidden agenda? Was it? I mean, where did the notion that we're not going to use this army to attack our own people? We're also not just going to use this army in the event that we're attacked. We're going to use this army to acquire things.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the interesting thing about the context in which this debate was sort of taking place, is that it isn't taking place in the abstract, right? Like, as you say so rightly, it really wasn't a matter of, like, let's just wait and see if we're attacked and make sure we have a good, strong army to defend ourselves. The nation was formed, you know, things were ongoing all the time while the nation was being formed. And one of the things that was ongoing was an effort that had begun before the revolution, in fact, for an elite group of speculators in Western land to get a hold of that land with the purpose of making money. So all of these things are tied up together in ways that are quite complicated and affect trying to figure out to what extent there were agendas and to what extent those agendas were open in some cases or hidden in other cases. And how it lines up? Like, does everyone who was against the standing army was everyone who was against the standing army sort of in favor of leaving the native people alone? No, they just thought that militias should take care of that job of securing the West. You know, so it doesn't even break down anti-imperialist, anti-militarist necessarily. So, your question goes to the heart, really, I think, of a number of fascinating issues that are bound up together in that moment of forming the nation, where we're already in the process, actually, of an imperial adventure. And it was open in the sense that Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, people on various sides of a lot of political issues, all used the term empire in a very sort of admiring way to talk about what the national goals really were. So Jefferson might call it an empire for liberty or an empire of liberty, and Hamilton might think of it as more like an empire to compete financially with the British Empire. Washington definitely envisioned empire, and he meant the pursuit of development, real estate development, essentially, in the West. They all used the term empire. So in that sense, I would say it wasn't all that hidden. In another sense, though, when the arguments were taking place, when the debates were taking place, they were often taking place in a less than candid context, as politics being then as it is now. You know, everyone's not always saying what they really mean. And so there was this ongoing sort of struggle, which a lot of people didn't even want to call a war, which was to pacify, they would say, the West and make and be able to use that land and speculate in that land and make good on a lot of investment in that Western land. So your question goes to the heart of a very important this is what I think is so important about this moment, actually, because we often think of imperialism as beginning sort of at the end of the 19th century, when we went sort of off our away from our natural boundaries and started expanding, you know, beyond the continent. But of course, in fact, expansion beyond into the West, what was called the West then, expansion beyond the Ohio River, was a basic cause of it was one of the causes of forming a nation, and had indeed been one of the causes of fighting the Revolution. So that expansionist mentality was actually cooked very deeply into the original ideas of the Republican nation that this nation was becoming, even as it began.
I mean, I guess maybe the initial founders of the state, or those who landed on Plymouth Rock, were not necessarily seeking to expand, seeking out resources to ship across the ocean, but certainly the resources that followed were a function of that. And so in some ways, I guess this sort of like this imperialist drive was inherited in some fashion.
Yeah, and again, that's very interesting. I mean, you're right that the book focuses, its main action focuses in the first half of the 1790s, but in order to sort of bring those impulses that I'm describing to life, you have to look a little further back. And in the book, I don't look all the way back to the immediate, to the absolute origin of, you know, contact and first white settlement. But I do look back to the formation of what was called the Ohio Company of Virginia by a bunch of Virginia speculators who were George Washington's older brothers and their friends and family connections. And you do see this, I mean, you know, some of it's regional, like Virginians were very interested in this, and many Pennsylvanians were very interested in this. And it's not as if New Englanders weren't interested, but a lot of the impulse behind this kind of expansionism seems to be the most successful, I should say, I guess, comes out of Virginians and Pennsylvanians. So, you know, there were many, many different sort of contributing factors to original European settlement and appropriation of land on this continent. But one of those threads, and it's the thread that led, the reason it's important is it led very, maybe in a convoluted way, I was going to say very directly, maybe in a convoluted way, but nonetheless inexorably led toward the formation of a military nation state here. Comes out of this desire for speculation, land speculation, and land development west of the Ohio River, west of the Alleghenies, and then west of the Ohio River.
All right. Well, let's follow the money if we could. But before we do, why do you think Virginia and Pennsylvania? I mean, or is that have I asked the same two questions?
That's a really good question. I mean, one of the things, you know, you mentioned my earlier books when you were introducing me, much appreciated. One of them is called Declaration. And in writing this new book, Autumn of the Black Snake, I realized that I'd kind of blown an opportunity in Declaration to look at both the New England side and the Virginia side in more detail. I gave a lot of attention in that book to how New Englanders kind of overthrew the Pennsylvania government in an effort to bring about the Declaration of Independence. But I mentioned the collaboration with Virginia, which was very important that New England and Virginia collaborated there. But I feel like the agendas there were somewhat different, and where a Samuel Adams, there were New Englanders who were, of course, invested in Western land, but where a Samuel Adams wanted to form a kind of a revived New England and a kind of what he called a Christian Sparta and make a kind of virtuous, sort of almost back to the Puritan kind of mentality in New England, he was collaborating with Virginians who were really interested in something completely different, had no interest in a Christian Sparta, but were trying to get land policy in Virginia kind of into their own hands. And what drives those two things is a very interesting question. I mean, I'm not going to say that the New Englanders were free of their own forms of deep desire to get ahead. I mean, we know about John Hancock and the Hancock family, and actually the Adams family as well, you know, the Samuel Adams family. And they were definitely business-oriented people trying to get ahead. This drive to the West, I think, comes partly out of understanding that that tobacco, which did not, of course, become the king crop of America, but it looked at the time it was the king crop of America, that the Virginia tobacco planters in particular became aware that tobacco just destroys the soil in which it's grown. And they just knew that there was going to be an endless need for more and more new fertile land that hadn't been tapped for that kind of destruction. So I think that was one of the main impulses, and I think the Virginians just had an earlier sense of the potential, you know, bonanzas to be made not only in tobacco but in the land on which tobacco could someday be grown.
It's eerie to contemplate that sort of attitude towards tobacco by the tobacco producers at that time, because that attitude seemed pretty durable through history.
Yeah, it's fascinating that way. Yes, it's true.
All right. Well, let's talk about let's follow some of that money. I mean, in terms of that argument about a standing army or not, those who are arguing for it, particularly Washington and Hamilton, and I think you've nearly alluded to it, but had some interest in the idea of an expansive America.
Yeah, strong interest. And I don't think that, I mean, just from Hamilton's point of view, for example, since Hamilton is so talked about right now, I think it's important to keep in mind that his really comprehensive and very ambitious sort of vaulting vision of what the United States could be involved a kind of meeting between high finance, high finance, elite money yoked to national purposes, combined with expansion managed from the top down, federally managed expansion into those valuable areas, speculation in Western land and the development of Western land, combined with a strong, very strong military presence. So that was really like his vision was really kind of comprehensive in that way. And it's kind of how many people in the 18th century who were interested in nationhood, I think, would have conceived of just simply what a nation is, what a nation state would be. It would have, you know, it would be a concentration of wealth yoked to a concentration of military power with a kind of expansionist, a kind of greater nationhood mentality. I mean, I don't think it makes the United States unique. It's just very interesting that there was also pushback against that idea. And it's also very interesting that you get into an issue around like, well, what are the legitimate boundaries of the United States when you're talking about indigenous people already living in those places where that speculation was going on. But certainly Hamilton's vision, and he was certainly not alone either. He was joined by Washington, who had a direct personal financial interest in that region, as did so many others of the elites in the founding generation. They really couldn't have imagined, I think, a United States pinned behind, you know, east of the mountains, never to expand, never to grow. I think that would be almost unimaginable to them as a United States. So that was how they looked at it. And to get what they needed to do that, they had to have an army, and they had to conquer. They had to actually conquer that area.
Well, I mean, when you lay out Hamilton's vision, it doesn't seem terribly different than what a monarch's country would look like at that time. I guess there's only the difference that theoretically there's more democracy in that, right? I guess, I mean, the difference would be in how they come to decide to arrive at that same sort of disposition.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think that's really interesting, the way to put it. I wouldn't say that Hamilton would have looked at, you know, because we have a different kind of government here that is not a monarchical government, or even a king in parliament, as in the English government at that time, or whatever, because we're not doing it that way, ergo, we won't be expansionist. That was not an equation that would have made any sense to him, or many of the other people of his type who thought the way he did. It wouldn't necessarily in any way follow in the way Hamilton thought of these things, that because we have a republic, therefore we wouldn't be expansionist. And I think he had some good, historical backup for that. I mean, this gets into some very interesting things that I think Americans argue about, you know, today, which has to do with like, what is legitimate, you know, use of influence beyond your borders, and to what extent is it imperialist, and to what extent is it, or isn't it imperialist, and so forth? Because these guys, the founding generation, had as one of their examples, of course, the Roman Empire, and they were extremely immersed in classical reading. And those who were anti-imperialist sort of had an idea that, you know, that an emperor, a monarch type, is always going to want to be militaristic and expansive. And some had the idea, and I think we inherit this sort of delusion, that if you have a republican government, as in the earlier Roman government, the one that was pre-imperial, the sort of lean, mean, virtuous republic idea, that it's not an expansionist, that it doesn't have an expansionist or militaristic component. But that wasn't really true about Rome itself, let alone the United States. It's more like you're always expanding. The question is, do you have a dictator at the top, or do you have a more Republican approach to who's running it? But expansionism doesn't live or die necessarily on whether there's an emperor or an elected government.
Well, I mean, was the perception that it's not expansionist if everybody agrees to do it? Or, I mean, I don't, how do you come to that reading? Of
I guess I would say this. I don't think I don't think you would call it not expansionist. You just wouldn't call it un-Republican to expand.
Right.
You know, that's what I mean.
Right, okay.
And I think that's the way Rome, I mean, Rome did plenty of expanding during its Republican era too. I don't think they looked at it that way, I guess.
Those who were concerned with a standing army, did they have concerns? Did they have, and maybe they wouldn't have articulated it this way, an anti-imperialist perspective? Maybe it would have been more like, if you have a standing army, you know, at one point you run to the end of the ocean and then it starts turning back in on yourself. Or what is it? What was the argument there? Was it just simply too similar to what the king had?
Yeah, well, the argument I think there would be, and this goes to your earlier point as well, the argument against the standing army and the argument is that once you have one, it just tends, having one, if you have one, you're going to use it.
Right.
Would be one. And always in a state of war. I mean, this is the Republican sort of recoil from certain kinds of war making was based on the idea that if you, you know, the more you're at war, the more likely you're going to give the executive power. I think this, again, goes into arguments that we've been having over the past, you know, the past 100 years and the past 20 years. I mean, once you're in a state of war, the executive is going to have more power. That's always the way things seem to work. So isn't there an incentive then on the part of the executive to be warlike? So that actually sometimes it's, you know, wagging the tail's wagging the dog. You're actually, the executive is looking for war situations in order to increase executive power. Hamilton was directly accused of this kind of mentality when he was, and often rightly so. I think he was very drawn to the idea that you know, war making increases power in the executive, and he liked both. He had a martial sort of attraction, and he also was very, very strong on a vigorous, powerful executive. So this was definitely part of the argument. It sometimes made some people, even, you know, to go slightly against my earlier point, some people really were against expanding. Also, I should give them credit as well. There was also an anti-expansionist mentality, and even a pro-native mentality among some of the Eastern thinkers, that it was just wrong to go take these people's land. And also that it was wrong to just keep expanding, because expansionism leads to militarism, and militarism leads to more dictatorial kinds of power. So that mentality did exist. That kind of protest did exist.
Those were the early social justice warriors, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the people who were really abolitionist, like Quakers, for example, many of them were also very opposed to expanding into Indian territory. And there was a sort of a noble savage romanticism even among some people about how actually that the native people are more natural republicans than we are. They're more democratic, and they're nobler and finer, and they don't seek to expand, and they don't seek to make war. And we should be more like them and not be taking their land. So those threads in our culture existed also right from the beginning.
So let's return to some of the history that you talk about. There's this massacre of American troops known as the St. Clair's defeat. Tell us what were the circumstances of that defeat? Was this a function of a half-hearted attempt to expand, or was it or what?
It was a full-on attempt to expand across the Ohio River, but it was half-hearted in its military effectiveness, because there was sort of an idea that the Washington administration had that we can just do this without actually bringing this argument to a total head. We can just sort of tell Congress, like, it's not going to take that much to do. It's sort of a simple mop-up. There's not that much opposition. We're just going to send a small force. We don't have to go crazy here. Just give us enough and we'll do it quickly. And they were underrating, both for political reasons and also, I think, sincerely at the same time, underrating the degree of extreme opposition on the part of the indigenous people who lived there, and the degree to which they had become sophisticated, both politically and militarily, in their resolve to keep the United States back east of the Ohio River. So you use the term massacre, and I'm just going to dissent from that a little bit, because it was a battle. Massacre tends to imply some kind of unfair, something, I don't know, sort of unfair, or a slaughter of innocents and so forth. It was a battle in which the United States, it was the first battle that the United States as a nation ever fought. There's a book about it by Colin Calloway called, I think, The Battle with No Name, I forget the exact name of the, it's strange that it doesn't have a name, because it was the first battle the United States ever fought as a nation. And it was a total
maybe
defeat.
That's why.
Yeah, exactly. That's my theory too. That's why we don't have a name for it, because the first battle we ever fought was an abject defeat, coming out of arrogance and poor discipline on the U.S. side, and excellent tactics and strategy and superb discipline on the native side. So that's called Sinclair. I mean, it does have a name. It's sometimes called Sinclair's defeat, but if you say that to most people, they've never heard of it. Just in terms of actual numbers of casualties, it puts like the Battle of the Little Bighorn much later and much better known. It makes it look like nothing. I mean, it was a massive victory. We call it a defeat, but actually the other way to look at it, of course, is that it was a thrilling victory on the part of the Native Confederation that achieved it. It actually ended up being the high water mark of Native resistance to U.S. expansion westward. And yet still, it isn't known or talked about much, so, which again is why I wanted to write this book.
So one would think that the results, right? I mean, if I guess they call this war the mulligan, if it was sold in Washington as like, this is, don't worry about this, a little mop up type of situation, not a big deal. We got it. You know, this is such a tiny mm-hmm. deal that we got this. You would think, intuitively, you would think like, oh, if they're massively defeated, this is going to make people gun shy. And they're going to say, we're just not going to engage in this type of stuff. But within a couple of years, we've got a standing army. What happens?
Well, one thing that happened is a lot of politics, a lot of, you know, sort of politics, junkie level politics, how the Washington administration turned this, you know, egregious defeat or this thrilling victory from the Indian point of view into a political wedge to actually get what they'd always wanted anyway. We have to keep in mind, because we were just talking about that, they always wanted a standing army anyway. It's one of these odd moments where, on the one hand, it was a horrible defeat and much life was lost. And Washington was sincerely, I believe, he had a total meltdown, a total temper tantrum when he heard about it. I believe he was sincerely shocked and horrified by the defeat. On the other hand, as so often happens in politics, and especially if you're a really tough, savvy politician, which Washington was, you can turn that around and turn it into a political victory. And yes, on the one hand, you'd think people would be gun shy. On the other hand, this was a terrifying moment of yes, defeat, but also it seemed like, well, what's going to happen next? I mean, all of the settlers out there are going to be killed, will be, you know, to use the word, massacred. There won't be any defense out there. What are they going to do next? Are they going to come all the way to Pittsburgh, which was sort of the western, you know, the western frontier edge? Are they going to burn Pittsburgh down and kill everyone there? I mean, how far back is the frontier going to be pushed? And people had family and friends living out there, trying to live out there. And then there was the development group, the owners really of a lot of that land, the speculators in that land, who thought of themselves as its owners, who were among the elites, who were deeply committed to defending those investments. And so there were a multitude of factors, which I get into, but through some very adroit and tough politicking, the Washington administration pushed through Congress, partly by using public opinion, partly by manipulating Congress into situations in which it would just have looked politically inexpedient not to vote the way the administration wanted Congress to vote. I mean, good old American, you know, politics. And I should add that in the administration at the time were Hamilton, of course, and also Jefferson, who we rightly see as bitter enemies, and they certainly did hate each other's guts at that time. However, they worked together as Washington subordinates on this project with Henry Knox as well to bring about the political machinations, some open and some back room, that got the Army bill passed through the House. And then Washington made some other deals with senators to get it through the Senate. And not very long after that horrible defeat, we did indeed have the first United States professional national United States Army.
I mean, I gotta say, as you're going through the varied agendas behind this, right? This pre-existing desire to have a standing army and all that implies, both from a defensive standpoint, but also from an expansive standpoint, the pre-existing financial incentives, and mm-hmm. then the sort of like the ginning up. Arguably, maybe not ginning up, but it sounds like it, of fears of, you know, if we don't get them there, we got to fight them here. I mean, it sounds very reminiscent of the buildup to the Iraq War, to probably many other of our conflicts, that this stuff is, I mean, is it that, and maybe I'm wrong in that assessment, and you'll tell me, but if I'm right, is it that these dynamics are basically eternal, or is it that these dynamics seem to be eternal, at least in the context of American history, because this was the pattern that we got in at the beginning?
Yeah, these dynamics are original in American history. I think that's a lesson of looking at this period and this war that nobody ever looks at, this first war we ever fought. Whether they're eternal, meaning like, are we going to be bound by such issues forever in the future because we began this way? I wouldn't want to say that.
Right. But I guess, I mean, did they
happen?
Were these
but
dynamics
I think you mean original,
existing
I mean,
in nature, or was it simply like, you know, we got in, this is the way the country was founded. You know, at a very, you know, if we look at, you know, sir, there's a lot of things locked in for people around the ages of 3 or 4, you know, and 5. And and it's as if like, yeah, this is what happened when we were in preschool and in kindergarten. And, you know, as adults, we still function the same way as a nation.
Yeah, I do see this as sort of embryonic in that sense and baked in pretty, you know. Baked in pretty early, all the dynamics we're talking about, everything you just went through, that does seem to me so, you know, so reminiscent of, or since we're going the other way, sort of potentially predictive of some of the issues around getting into Vietnam and some of the issues around getting into Iraq. A lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the combinations of, as you've said, ginning up, which is absolutely was part of the tactic. People having pre-existing agendas, which then get fulfilled in conditions of crisis, being able to sort of try to drag Congress kicking and screaming through a series of states of emergency, where it would just be politically inexpedient to vote against a certain resolution, say, all of those things. You know, obviously, I'm reading the original history back through my knowledge of contemporary history, and one could say that I'm overreading it that way. But to just, you know, and that, so that would be an interesting argument to have. But I do think, to your point, that the things that we have gotten used to in some of our later wars are embryonic to this first war, and maybe more embryonic to this first war than some of the better known wars, which again goes back to the question of why have we forgotten about this war? Why isn't it part of our public discussion? And I think the reason is because possibly it's embryonic and it reflects on later issues that we don't want to deal with either.
those later issues being how we came about. I mean, it would have been one thing, right? I guess if we had had a standing army because we were under attack versus we were going on attack.
Right. I mean, why do we go to war? And why do we like to think we go to war versus why do we actually go to war, for example? I mean, those kinds of issues. What is the rhetoric of war, of making war? When why do we define certain wars as legitimate and others as maybe in retrospect illegitimate? How do we get around those objections, those protests, those dissents against going to war at the time that a certain element really wants to go to war? I think all of those things can be seen in this first war, which just makes it just continues to blow my mind that we just don't know about this war. But I think it's because it's so revealing of the bases of these problems that we have as a nation in trying to define what we think is a legitimate reason to fight a war.
Let me just ask you, as a historian, I mean, I think as someone who's not a historian and sort of I think my relationship to history was fairly rudimentary as I don't think I had any relationship to history as a mode of thinking. And I mean, as we talk about these dynamics that started with tobacco a couple hundred years ago, and you know, it's almost as if these things, someone once told me about social work, that when you see a family that is incredibly dysfunctional, that you have to understand that's taken generations to get there, that these mm-hmm. problems are sort of passed down, you know, from one interaction to another. Parent to child, and then child grows up to be parent to their child, and they are directly implicated through the generations. I mean, is this story tell us that perhaps it's the same way? I mean, you could say that about the tobacco industry, that we understand we're going to run out of, of places to grow, but we're also going to run out of consumers at one point. We've got to hide certain things. If there isn't the same dynamic here that is resonating, not as sort of a distant example, but as one that is part of a continuum and this sort of mentality, it worked then, the way they went about getting that standing army, and these practices are sort of passed down generation to generation.
Yeah, that's a very interesting set of thoughts. I mean, yeah, maybe. One way I guess I would think about that in terms of the story I'm telling here is one of the interesting things that I get into toward the end of the book, where I sort of try to look ahead after there's no suspense to the book, you know, Ohio and Indiana and Illinois become part of the United States, as everybody knows. So after that has happened, then looking ahead to like, well, what happens to the standing army and what happens to the Midwest, which of course immediately, very almost immediately becomes this incredible industrial driver of American empire, you know, around the world, which goes, I think, right to what you're talking about, this kind of generational development. One of the things that happens kind of early on in that is that, you know, the Jefferson point of view, Jefferson was working with Hamilton and Knox and Washington to bring about this standing army, but he was always odd man out in this area, in the cabinet, in Washington's cabinet. And as we know, you know, party politics begins right in the period that I'm talking about. And Jefferson very soon leaves the cabinet and becomes a member of the opposition party. And by the time everything's resolved in the story I'm telling, we begin to get pushback against the Federalist Party, partly because they were accused of being militarists. And once Washington was out of power and Hamilton was sort of trying to run everything from outside of power as well, the Federalist Party does become the military budgets just go through the roof, and it just suddenly, they don't have Washington to sort of, I don't know, make it more politic, make it more palatable. They just seem like they're out of control. And really, to some extent, you know, Hamilton tried to, you know, was pushing for a war with France at that point, which didn't happen at that point. But that brought down the Federalist Party in a way. And Jefferson's party, as we know, came in. And the way Jefferson's party was presenting themselves, they were the anti-militaristic party at this point. And Jefferson, people looked at it as like, well, this is the real American Revolution. Now we're back on track. Those guys went crazy. They were tyrannical and militaristic, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you look at what happens next, of course, again, if you really, I mean, everyone already knows this, but if you put it in this context, it's rather striking that, well, it's really during the Jefferson era that the country really begins to expand westward, because of course, it was Jefferson who made the Louisiana Purchase, and the army, and there had to be a military presence further and further west. And Jefferson too wanted to, he's the one who actually starts talking about moving all of the recalcitrant native people across the Mississippi River. He put it in, literally, he said, for their own good. I think that's an exact quote. He didn't want to put it in such a harsh way, but in fact, the next quote unquote generation of government in America, which was supposed to be much more lean, mean Republican, much less militaristic, it's really during the Jefferson administration that everything Washington and Hamilton and Knox fought for comes into its biggest fruition. And you could even jump a number of generations ahead and look at Teddy Roosevelt's era. And there's Roosevelt now looking offshore. You know, he wanted to go to Cuba, and you know, now we need the Philippines, and we need to get beyond the continent. And he looked back at the very war that I'm talking about, which has so since been forgotten in the public discussion, but Teddy Roosevelt was very keenly aware of the war that I'm writing about, and he saw it. I mean, he was openly and celebratorily claiming that this war, this Indian War, the first war the nation ever fought, the war for the Midwest, he was claiming it as a precedent for what he wanted to do. When people objected to what Roosevelt was trying to do, he said, why don't you just go talk to the Indians and tell them, you know, give the land back. I mean, come on, this is what we do, he said. Wake up, grow up. We've been doing it since day one. He had a realpolitik attitude toward it, and many of us have chosen instead to sort of forget what happened then. And we wouldn't want to adopt Roosevelt's point of view on it necessarily, of course. But the question then becomes, what do we do with it? What do we do with it? How do we want to construct it and contextualize where we come from? Because I think, to your larger point, I mean, the longer we don't look at these things, the more likely we are to exactly do what you're talking about, which is repeat and repeat and repeat in that same way you're talking about. Well, we've worked before, and now we'll try something else that's similar, and it'll work again in a different context, and we don't change. So that's kind of why I like to unearth this kind of stuff.
William Hoagland, the book is Autumn of the Black Snake, The Creation of the U.S. Army and the Invasion that Opened the West. Thank you so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a fun discussion.
Welcome, patrons, to this week's Illicit History. I'm Michael Brooks, of course. Thank all of you so much for being patrons. Keep reaching higher and higher in that number. Thank you all very, very much. And this week's Illicit History, I'm going to take you on a brief tour through the career of Michael Manley, who was a Jamaican prime minister, democratic socialist, leader of the international non-aligned movement, and someone who had, in fact, a very tragic political story that went from the 1960s to 1990s and told sort of many things through that story, from a certain kind of politics, through the role of the CIA in developing nations. And there's a couple of other connected strands here from what happened in Jamaica in the 70s and what led to the 80s. There's going to be a thread involving Bob Marley briefly, a very brutal gang called the Shower Posse, and Edward Seaga, who is also an iconic Jamaican political figure, still alive, and a figure of the right in Jamaica. But let's get started by talking about Michael Manley. Michael Manley was the son of a Jamaican independence leader. He was educated at the London School of Economics. He was an avid practitioner of democratic socialism, and he, in the 1972 election, was leading the People's National Party, which he had been preceded as leader by his father, Norman Manley, who, as I say, was a Jamaican independence leader and founder of the People's National Party. Now, there was already a bit of a shift. Norman Manley was a liberal, someone to the sort of center-left, focused on Jamaican independence, but very procedural, very well-educated, upper-class, and certainly not one with a common touch or particularly radical agenda. Michael Manley was very privileged, very well-educated. As I said before, he was educated at the London School of Economics. But he inherited a much more intense charisma than his father, as well as a more, not necessarily radical, not Cuban, but very robust commitment to anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, and, in fact, democratic socialism. So we're just going to play really briefly. This is from 1972, a campaign rally of Michael Manley, sort of in his prime, speaking to a crowd in Jamaica, and you'll get a flavor of his campaign style here.
We've come too far, we're not turning back now. We have a pride now, we have a place now, we have a mission now, and a safety, my friends. Together we are going to march forward under God's heaven, building democratic socialism. Glory to socialism!
Michael Manley said, yes, people, better must come. Give me a chance and better must come. Better will come. And so they bought it.
That was an opposition party figure speaking in a documentary called Blood and Fire, and you got a flavor of Manley's style there. He took office in 1972, and he did implement a series of reforms. Land reform, he expanded education programs, and he also worked with creating a National Housing Trust, which helped build affordable and free housing. He eliminated discrimination for children born out of wedlock and implemented other significant reforms. I'm going to quote now from a piece in The Jacobin, which will be linked to. In 1973, Manley started renegotiating taxes on bauxite, Jamaica's main mineral export. Under previous governments, this valuable resource had been mined at ridiculously low rates, and broad cross-sections of the local population greeted the bauxite levy as it was known. The U.S. State Department noted this development rarely, but alarm bells did not go off until 2 years later. One more quote from this piece. In 1975, Agostinho Neto's Marxist-oriented popular movement for the liberation of Angola, MPLA, led Angola to a hard-fought independence. Almost immediately, the South African apartheid regime invaded, supported by Neto's domestic opponents. Without help from an outside force, his army could not hope to match South Africa's modern and mechanized forces. Fidel Castro offered his aid, but the well-trained and equipped Cuban forces were an ocean away. Cuban forces needed to refuel on their way to Angola, and Manley, along with Forbes Burnham in Guyana and Errol Barrow in Barbados, agreed to provide landing bases and diplomatic cover for the Cuban forces. Washington objected strongly to this, and Henry Kissinger went personally to see Manley and demand that his government withdraw support for the Cubans and their effort in fighting for a leftist government in Angola and against South Africa's apartheid forces. And Manley actually wrote about this incident in a 1982 book called Struggle in the Periphery. He declined Kissinger's request, apparently quite forcefully, and pushed Kissinger's hand out of his face. Now, this, along with the sort of opposition of the old school aristocracy and oligarchy of Jamaica, led to increasing pressure on the Manley government, so that by 1975, you saw immense acts of political violence and intensity, fueled by gunmen who were aligned with both parties. Now, in Jamaica, by this point in the 70s, you had cities like Kingston split up into different garrisons, different neighborhoods that were represented by different parties that would distribute patronage in different networks. So depending on whose party was in charge could affect your building contracts, your housing, your employment contracts, and your social welfare. And in order to get out the vote in these neighborhoods, there were gunmen and gangs associated with both of the major parties, the People's National Party, as led by Michael Manley, and the Jamaica Labor Party, led by Edward Seaga. Now, the Jamaica Labor Party, unlike its name might indicate, was the party of the right. It was, although it did have some connections with certain Jamaican labor unions. And Seaga, who himself a sort of fascinating figure, which we'll get to a bit more later, was a Harvard-trained anthropologist who had had a background in the record industry and had a constituency called Tivoli Gardens, which he constructed on a kind of Danish model of social progress. At the same time, he was deeply connected with his gunmen, more so than Manley, arguably, and was very eager and willing to use violence in the lead-up to the 1976 election. This, along with what many allege was a sort of beginning of a CIA destabilization campaign of Jamaica, which would accelerate throughout the latter part of the 70s as a result of Manley's charting an independent foreign policy and jeopardizing capitalist and traditional interests in Jamaica. Now, in this clip here, it's from a speech that was an important part of the sort of kickoff and setting of the 1976 campaign. Michael Manley's, in a party address to the People's National Congress, in the We Know Where We Are Going speech. This is Manley talking about the state that Jamaica had been under the previous ruling elite, some of the changes in Jamaican society under his leadership, and why Jamaica would not turn back.
The country was bankrupt spiritually, bankrupt morally, and in the years, those who had been wealthy had grown more wealthy. Those who had been privileged had grown more privileged. Those who were poor had grown poorer. And those who had no rights had sunk deeper into despair. And the people of Jamaica looked at that and they said, no more, no way. And those are the people that now want to come back. No way. No way. And comrades, the reason why we were in that condition, because we, the Jamaican people, were trapped. We were trapped in a world system that we call imperialism, and we were trapped in a local system that we call capitalism. And we set about in 1972 with your mandate for change. But we realized that there could be no change in this country unless we were prepared to change the system, unless we were prepared to join the international struggle against imperialism, and unless we were prepared to reorganize Jamaica to replace the capitalist system with a socialist system.
So there he is outlining this agenda. And as many have pointed out, or at least some have pointed out, that again, this is a guy who identified himself as a democratic socialist. He had an independent foreign policy aligned with Cuba with regards to fighting imperialism and apartheid, which would be the policy of any self-respecting anti-colonial leader in the world, but he never stepped out of parliamentary norms. There was no real indication, despite accusations by Siaga and others, that this was heading in a Cuba sort of dictatorship direction. As he won re-election in 1976, in spite of increased violence and pressure from Siaga and almost certainly pressure from the United States, as his term wore on, the combination of destabilization campaign, as I say, which was in fact alleged by a rogue CIA agent, Philip Agee, who quit the agency and actually exposed and specifically named agents on the ground in Jamaica, independent pressure, U.S. corporations fleeing, money, foreign direct investment pulling back. And then, of course, that cycle that you did see in the 70s where, you know, there was deficit spending in vital investments in education and public services and relieving poverty, but there also wasn't a sort of general kind of liberation of resources and other vital factors in the Jamaican economy. So the middle class started to leave. Tourism was hurt. There was a propaganda campaign against Manley. Commodity prices for things like bauxite went down. And now, to quote again from the Jacobin, after some hesitation and an attempt to consult the Jamaican people through a popular initiative, Manley chose the IMF. In other words, he chose to engage in the later 70s with the IMF. A series of agreements, increasing austerity, tore into the few advances that poor and working people had made, contributing to Manley's declining popularity and shifting balances of nationality. And now we have a clip here from a Jamaican documentary called Blood and Fire, which is going to cover some of the violence also, which only increased in the 1980 election, and also the broader kind of what it meant that this guy whose politics was about really almost delivering a New Deal FDR-style program for Jamaica, who was so squeezed by capital, traditional interests in the CIA, what bowing to the IMF austerity package actually meant.
Michael had enough grassroots support to win the 1976 election, but the crisis still deepened. Foreign businesses found more friendly places to invest their money.
They frightened away every foreign investor that we had, and a lot of local investors at the same time, because they were threatened. They were told that they were not the sort of people that were not wanted here, that Jamaica was going to be a socialist country, and that the capitalist was no longer welcome. America was called a wicked imperialist capitalist nation and exploiter, and the whole ambience of the place was very frightening to any kind of investment.
Of greater concern, the urban poor were losing patience. Michael Manley had no choice but to bow to US pressure as his socialist dream of a free, equal, independent Jamaica crumbled before his eyes. He went to the World Bank and effectively handed over the running of the country to the IMF. Jamaica's future would now be in the hands of foreigners.
He was, you know, sort of a proud person who felt that although your country was small, that you had rights like everybody else. And I think he realized the extent to which these rights were going to be withdrawn.
Less than 20 years of independence had brought the island back to financial slavery. The IMF loan of $29 million was not enough and came with strings attached, which put an end to social reforms and led to shortages.
We can't get oil, we can't get detergent, we can't get flour, we can't get rice. And everything on a whole you can't get.
Oh no, Mr. IMF, no.
For some crazy reason, I chose to have a baby in that 1980 election year. And he was premature. He was in the hospital for about 3 weeks in the intensive care unit at the hospital for premature babies. And I was able to interact with working class mothers on a day-to-day basis. They'd all come, we'd all come to visit the baby and our babies. And, you know, we'd talk. And one of the things we talked about was the shortage of foodstuff.
That was Michael Manley's former wife, And in 1980, Edward Sciaga would win. It would be another enormously violent election with very heavy artillery. And we're going to take now a brief sort of two detours, which are very, one quite inspiring, the other deeply disturbing, to kind of illustrate Edward Sciaga, and then come full circle with Michael Manley. Many people are familiar with a couple of things, iconic things in Jamaica. Bob Marley was shot during the 1976 election, and he also still performed at the One Love Peace concert. And in this clip, Bob Marley actually brought together the arms of Edward Sciaga and Michael Manley, which now I think for people listening and studying this history can see that this wasn't a sort of generic call for peace and unity, but quite literally someone trying to intervene in an incredibly violent and dangerous situation where anybody could have been shot, potentially even in that moment. We're going to take a few minutes from this and then talk about a disturbing angle on this story that can also potentially reflects on Edward Sciaga. Riots. I show the people that everything is all right.
What you doing? 'Cause I wanna send the matches right out there. I mean, I'm not so good at talking, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. Well, I'm trying to say, could we have up here on stage here the presence of Mr. Michael Manley and Mr. Edward Sciaga? Oh! We just want to shake hands and show the people that we're gonna meet them right. We're gonna unite. We're gonna meet them right. We got to unite.
Adrian, it seems as if Marley's dreams are coming true. Bob is feeling the love of Jah as he invites Prime Minister Michael Manley and the opposition leader Edward Sciaga on stage. Tell you that one crucial.
I'm waiting. Hold on. Help us out, I'm praying. Good Lord of mine, you know you mean I'm good.
Was a very inspiring and iconic moment, and unfortunately it didn't leave much of an impact. In fact, part of the impetus behind the effort for this concert were gang leaders connected with both Jamaica Labour Party and People's National Party that Bob Marley knew, trying to broker peace and actually sort of create a discourse in ghetto Jamaica of why would they be gunmen for political elites. Two of the organizers of that concert ended up dying within 2 years of the concert, and in 1980 election there were 189 reported murders in Jamaica. So that is in 1980. The other aspect of this killing, and this will lead us to Siaga specifically, is that there is a gang called the Shower Posse, which was able to rise in Jamaica when Siaga took power in the 1980s. And the Shower Posse's was led by a guy named Jim Brown, or Lester Koch, who was a personal bodyguard and political enforcer for Edward Siaga, and was able to, in fact, travel on a diplomatic passport. I'm going to play one more clip for you. This is a documentary done by a guy named Al Proffitt, specifically on the Shower Posse. And there are rumors, which we will get to in a future episode, on who was behind that shooting effort of Bob Marley. And there is one theory that is going to draw a line from the Shower, and there's other theories that we'll get to in future episodes that draw a direct line between the Shower, the CIA, and Edward Siaga.
The political violence became so serious that Bob Marley, icon of Jamaican music and culture, was ambushed and shot during the 1976 election by unknown assailants. The word in the street was Edward Siaga backed gangsters from Tivoli Gardens, later birthplace of the Shower Posse, were involved. In 1980, Siaga's right-wing JLP launched an even more aggressive bid for power, some say with the help of the American CIA. Pitched gun battles were fought in the streets of Kingston between PNP-backed gangs and JLP supporters. Almost 900 people were killed in Jamaica that year, a new record.
So there you have it. In the 1980s, Edward Siaga would govern Jamaica with a friendship with Ronald Reagan, with a fusion of autocratic style and neoliberal austerity policies that favored foreign direct investment, brought a whole bunch of chains and fast food restaurants, and revitalized the elite tourism industry, and reinforced not only the traditional economic divisions of Jamaica, but also colorism and other sort of cultural things that Michael Manley in his Politics in the United States in the 1970s, rather, was trying to address. And Siaga, at the same time as he was sort of this very conservative, very pro-United States prime minister, he was also, and a hyper-capitalist, he was also a promoter of religious revivalism. He had had a background as a Harvard-trained anthropologist and experience in the record business. So he also built connections with different religious revivalist communities and fed on certain sort of cultural reactionary politics, which many people compared to the Duvalier regime in the 1980s. In 1989, Manley would actually return to power as a very softened and diminished figure. He had spent time in the 1980s writing. He lectured at Columbia University and City College and other places. And by the time of his return to power, he was ready to accept the world as it was, the strictures of global economics. He was very actively sought foreign direct investment. He did not want to anger the United States or the IMF or World Bank. He did maintain some independence and connection to Cuba. He did increase social investments and try to still deliver for the communities that he still could speak pretty passionately about and who the PNP was designed to serve. But by this point, both as someone who had been victimized in the international system and as the international currents had shifted so much in such a neoliberal direction, Michael Manley became almost a prototype of the type of third-way politics that would jet across the globe in the 1990s. He ended up dying in 1997 of cancer. Still a very important, little acknowledged, but very distinct figure in global politics, who did accomplish some very important things while being in the middle of a whirlwind of everything from capitalism to CIA to guns to really some of the most inspiring liberatory movements that we've seen in the modern world. Edward Seaga is still alive and still a presence in Jamaican politics and society. We're going to get into some of the details of some of these other things more in future episodes, but for now, this is your latest edition of Illicit History. I want to thank Matt Leck for, as always, being a great, very able producer, and thank all of you patrons so much. I'll see you on the Discord, and I'll see some of you in group calls soon, and the full show back on Tuesday.